we should not try to slow migration to cities. It's not going to be successful, and urbanization has much to offer.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. By 2050, the world's urban population will be almost 7 billion, and that's growth driven mainly by urbanization in developing countries. But is this creating unprecedented economic opportunity or just thousands of dead-end slums? And how can we plan cities in a developing world so that they are safer, healthier, and more productive? A new discussion paper brings together the research on these issues, and Ed Glaser of Harvard is one of the authors. Ed, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Ed, should development economists be more focused on cities? With these statistics, it sounds like they should be.
I want to give a completely unnuanced answer to this. Yes, they should be. And urban economists should be more focused on development. There is a great spatial mismatch in our knowledge. We know a great deal about cities in the developed world because they urbanized first, and consequently the field of urban economics has been disproportionately focused on the US first and Europe second. Yet the most interesting things that are happening in cities are happening in the developing world, and the most important things that are happening in cities are happening in the development world. At the same time, development economics has been disproportionately focused on rural areas because throughout almost all of history, to be poor was to be rural. And yet, as your question notes, overwhelmingly, the poorest parts of the world are becoming urban, and these cities are both places of enormous promise and enormous peril. And they require far better policymaking. They require the kind of expertise and brilliance that development economists can bring.
Yes, and with this rapid growth, it sounds like it's pretty urgent to come up with better development policies that are focused on these cities.
That is certainly true, but I want to give a warning there. This is not nuance, but this is a warning, which is that policy is always trumped by capacity. And it's really important for economists who are working on development world cities to not come up with just better things to do without having thought through the ability to actually do them, right? Most mayors, even in wealthy cities, have a relatively limited number of people who will actually do what they say. This paucity of human resources is even more true in the developing world. So as much as we need to think about what's the right policy towards traffic congestion, what's the right policy towards public health, what's the right policy towards public housing, we need to always keep in mind the limits of public capacity in developing world cities and be focused on how it is that we can increase that level of public capacity.
Now, in your paper, you look at the good and the bad impacts of urbanization in a developing world, and you pull together the research that's been done on that. And there is good news here, isn't there, that urban workers earn more. But I guess the causal effect of being in a city isn't quite that simple.
That's right. So urban economics for the past 30 years has thought a great deal about trying to estimate the treatment effect of living in a dense urban area. And the problems here are, first, the selection on the workers on observables. So workers in cities may be intrinsically more able. Secondly, there may be unobserved characteristics of the place, like a port or access to a mine, that both attract people there and then make them productive. And so there's now a long literature of trying to tease out that causality. And even once you're on that, there's a question as to whether or not they are earning more once you adjust for underlying prices. Now, the bulk of the urban economics literature has argued that in the West, we're in something of a spatial equilibrium, which means that you would expect higher prices to offset your higher incomes. That doesn't mean that cities aren't making people more productive, right? If they weren't more productive, then firms wouldn't be willing to pay for those higher wages. But it doesn't necessarily mean there's a free lunch from coming to cities. One of the nice things about development economics is the ability to run experiments. And I think one of my favorite papers in this area is Mushfiq Mubarak's work, where migrants are randomly induced to come to cities. And he finds that when they come to cities, they typically earn more. So that really does help us to pin down this causality and make the claim that urban areas really are generators of productivity, not just places that select more able people. The second just fact I want to put up, and this goes back to work that I did in the 1990s, is that cities don't seem to generate wage gains in the US or in Spain, as the work of De La Roca and Pugh have shown us, that's immediate. Instead, what you see is year by year, month by month, you see faster wage growth in these areas, which is I think most compatible with the view that cities are forges of human capital, places where people become productive by being surrounded by a maelstrom of economic activity. And these things, while not perfect experiments, at least are typically done with individual fixed effects, meaning that you're looking at the same person before they're in the city and after they come to the city and looking at the wage growth over that time period.
Now, you mentioned productivity, and we know that cities tend to be relied on by governments to produce growth as engines of growth. Now, at the macro level, do we know much about what type of cities are more productive?
Well, we know that human capital and density seem to be strong complements. So both in the US and in the developing world, areas with higher levels of education appear to be far more successful economically. And we see this in higher wages. We see this in higher wage growth. We see this in higher population growth. If anything, the impact of local education on local productivity appears to be stronger in Brazil, India, and China than it is in the United States. So education really does seem to be the bedrock on which urban success rests, as indeed the success of the nation and the individual also rests on human capital in the 21st century. So that's certainly the most important thing. And I think as we think about what policies cities in the developing world should be following to ensure productivity, the most important one is to be focused on the education of their citizenry. But there are other things as well, right? There's a smaller literature in the US that documents the importance of a large number of highly competitive small firms for long-run economic success at the local level. If you think about, you know, what cities do, they are more important for little firms that can't solve all their problems in-house, that need to interact with each other, than they are for large, wholly integrated firms. Cities are also connected to the outside world, so those global connections are another part of what makes cities more likely to be engines of economic growth.
Which people do best out of migrating to cities? Is the benefit of migration shared equally?
Well, there is a great deal of heterogeneity in urban outcomes. I mean, the confluence, the connection of rich and poor in cities has been noted since Plato, who wrote that every city of whatever size is in reality two cities, one a city of the rich and the other a city of the poor. Now, this is partially about the uneven benefits of cities, but it's also because cities attract both the rich and the poor. Cities are particularly nice places to be rich, and they are less terrible places to be poor, and so they bring in the rich and the poor. Now, the sideline of that is that cities shouldn't apologize for their inequality as long as they are continuing to be engines of opportunity for poorer urbanites. And there's a question about whether or not they're continuing to do so. Some of the work that's been done on slums in sub-Saharan Africa and India tends to find that many slum residents have been in cities for decades without experiencing large wage gains. Of course, some of the multi-generational work that's gone on in slums, such as Perlman's work on favelas in Rio, does find that, you know, by the next generation, if you're not actually selecting on the people who are still in the slum, but you're looking at the children of the first generation, they really have done a lot better than their parents did or than people living in the rural northeast of Brazil did. Now, in terms of what individual characteristics predict success in cities, education tends to be a pretty big one. So again, there's this complementarity between human capital and urban density. Skills enable you to take advantage of the city and to do well in it. So once again, this is a variable which is highly predictive of urban success.
The problems of disease, ill health, pollution, they're really very much on everyone's mind at the moment. So for the sake of the people who live in these cities, does the research tell us that we should be investing more heavily in the urban infrastructure, or even should we be slowing down migration to cities in a developing world?
So I have for many years strongly embraced, non-nuanced answer to this question, which is we should not try to slow migration to cities. It's not going to be successful. And urbanization has much to offer, not just in terms of economic productivity, but also it's where political change comes from. It's where the pressure for improving the quality of government comes from. It's where cultural innovation comes from. It's where social movements come from. So to take the counter view, to engage in Luddite policies that attempt to artificially slow the growth of cities, it ends in failure. I'm not saying that you should ever artificially encourage people to come to cities. I don't believe that at all. I believe that the national government should have a level spatial playing field, should not favor one place over another. But by the same token, they shouldn't artificially discourage the growth of the most productive places in their country. But the counter of that is, they very much need to do battle with the demons that come with density. And you highlighted the most important ones. Disease, contagion, which stalks the world right now, has always been the greatest terror of the urban world. since the plague of Athens in 430 BC through the plague of Justinian, 541 AD, to the cholera epidemics and yellow fever epidemics of the 19th century up to COVID-19 and today. This is absolutely critical. Dealing with these problems required enormous investments in public infrastructure in 19th century America. America's cities and towns were spending as much on clean water at the start of the 20th century as the federal government was spending on everything except for the post office and the army. So it was an enormous amount of expenditure. And it wasn't just about money. It wasn't just about building the infrastructure. And we see this in sub-Saharan Africa as well. If you build the water mains, but you don't figure out how to solve the last mile problem, the infrastructure does no good. And that's exactly what happened in New York City for 25 years after the city built the Croton Aqueduct. Poor people were not connecting to the water and the city continued to have cholera epidemics. It was only after 1866 when the city instituted the Board of Health, which started imposing fines on tenement owners that didn't connect to the water main, that cholera finally started to disappear. And you're really going to need levels of investment in both infrastructure and in smart incentives in order to deal with these downsides of density in the developing world today.
What about crime? Do bigger cities mean more crime?
Well, they used to. So I wrote a paper in the 1990s about the relationship between crime and urban density in the United States, because it seemed like such an enduring part of America's urban life. Now, that was great timing on my part, because just as I was writing that paper, the relationship between crime and city size across the U.S. shrank mightily. And it's much flatter than it was in the 1990s. But there are some reasons why crime goes up with city size. It gets harder to catch criminals when there are a larger number of potential perpetrators. It is easier for criminals to find victims in a big city. And cities bring together poor people who want money with rich people who have money. That being said, there is a great deal of heterogeneity in crime levels in the cities across the world, right? Many East Asian cities are very safe. South Asian cities are really quite safe, despite the occasional Mumbai novel about gangsters harassing film stars. But in fact, you know, you walk around Dharavi and you're not frightened of anything. Sub-Saharan Africa is a little bit more mixed, and obviously it's very dependent upon particular countries. It's really Latin America, where crime has been a terrible scourge of urban areas. And huge investments have gone on in countries like Colombia and Mexico to try and make their cities livable. To a certain extent, it depends on whether or not the poorer urban areas tend to reproduce the relatively functional social structures that prevent crime that existed in the villages that preceded them. So you walk into an Indian high poverty area and, you know, you're greeted by the elder there, probably followed by 15 other people and a lot of children who are interested in you. And there are eyes on the street, there are eyes on you. If you tried to cause any mischief, someone would be watching you. That's not how it feels like when you walk into a favela in Rio, often because you see armed guards everywhere. But it's a very different feeling there. And also, of course, the terrible scourge of the international drug markets, which, of course, have been partially created by America's own policies towards drugs, have made things worse in Latin America.
Now, we understand a lot more these days about the role of institutions and the bad effects that weak institutions have in urban environments. If there are weak institutions in developing world cities, does it mean that we should involve the private sector more in the building and the running of these cities?
No. The answer to that is absolutely not. I believe very strongly that Deng Xiaoping was right when he said that it doesn't matter if a cat is black or white as long as it catches mice. We must, as economists, be resolutely pragmatic on this issue and recognize there are times for private sector provision of services and there are times when it's not appropriate. And we shouldn't rule it out in any context a priori. But one of the problems of having a private sector entity that operates with a public subsidy is that the private sector entity has very strong incentives to subvert the public sector, to use its cash revenues to bribe officials and to get what it wants and provide no public service. This is what happened in 19th century America with some degree of regularity. It's not like, you know, there's any developing world country that has more corruption than we have in our own past. And the answer was that private providers typically engaged in large degrees of larceny of the public coffers. Examples would include, you know, the failure to provide clean water in Manhattan in the early part of the 19th century, where instead of New York having their own public waterworks, which is the path that Philadelphia followed. They created a hybrid entity, which was a bank plus water company, the Manhattan Water Company. Aaron Burr was the godfather of this idea. And the bank was to provide subsidies for the water company. Now, of course, you know, you don't subsidize a socially valuable but non-lucrative activity by telling someone they can do another activity, which is far more lucrative, like banking. So this entity did a lot of banking and not a lot of water provision. It evolved into JP Morgan Chase. In the case of street cleaning in New York in the 19th century, there originally had been a private provider of street cleaning services who would kick back 50% of the public funds that were given to street cleaning to the political machine of Tammany Hall and would provide at best desultory services. It was only when street cleaning was brought into the city that quality actually improved. Now, that doesn't mean that there haven't also been major cost savings by switching to private provision in the 20th century. But there's no sense in which if you have a weak public sector or a limit on public capacity, then you necessarily should turn to the private sector. Another option, which is also fraught with some peril, is going the route of an independent public entity. This was very popular in the 19th century US, where semi-public entities like the Croton Aqueduct Commission or the Erie Canal Commission, later the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, Tennessee Valley Authority. These are all different models of public entities that are separated from the normal political goings on, which was an attempt to insulate them from political pressure and perhaps reduce the level of corruption. That type of thing can work, but only if you can get a world-class leader who has a lot, both of personal capacity and a lot of reputation to lose. Otherwise, you risk creating a malfunctioning parastatal enterprise that becomes even worse in terms of cronyism because the executive doesn't have to take responsibility for it. So you have to choose the institutions that work well for the context in which we are and not be ideological about any of it.
You write in the paper about how cities are complicated machines, and you talk about the benefits of structural models for how cities should be planned and developed. So what are they? What do they do?
Structural models are less common in development, which over the past 25 years, following the revolution wrought by my colleague Michael Kramer and the great Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo, has very much embraced a randomized controlled trial approach, which is a very sort of micro innovation. It's very good in terms of getting empirical answers, but it's very bad for thinking about systems typically. And cities are systems. And when you ask about something like building a bus rapid transit line or changing local land use restrictions, you will have changes that reverberate throughout the entire system because new structures will be built, workplaces will be changed, people will move, and the city will redefine itself in various ways. Structural models attempt to create some ability to predict how the entire system will react to a new innovation. And they've been particularly helpful for thinking about the impact of transportation innovations. David Donaldson, for example, used it looking at the rails of 19th century India. With Rick Hornbeck, he looked at America's 19th century intercontinental rail network. Steve Redding has done amazing work looking at transportation connections within the city of London or within Argentina. So these tools are being developed, but we're still at a relatively early stage. They also will be necessary and vital tools for policy planning, because if you are a city like Nairobi or like Delhi that's thinking about some form of transportation innovation, you want to evaluate what it's going to do, you're going to need to put together a full spatial model where you get to predict how the entire city will move around with that. As valuable as they are, and we as social scientists need to be ardently behind their development, we also need to be wary about applying their lessons too quickly to public policy. So we need to use them, but we need to be critical consumers, and we need to encourage policymakers to be critical consumers as well. Because when a research tool is in its early phase, there's lots of opportunities for picking and choosing answers that fit the policymaker's particular preference. And so we need to be a little bit wary of that.
But the RCT, the randomized controlled trial, is very much the go-to technique in development economics. Does this mean that they're not useful in cities?
They are useful, but you need to think about how they work in a systemic context. So, for example, the Mubarak study that I talked about is an example of an RCT that's very valuable for thinking about a deep urban question. These tools are somewhat less valuable for doing questions like large-scale infrastructure changes, right? So you can maybe do group-level interventions. Indeed, the original deworming study of Michael Kramer was, in fact, looking very much at an urban question of the spillovers from one person's deworming to their neighbors, and found, of course, that the whole was greater than the sum of the parts. So that's an urban question as well. But for these, it's hard to get someone to engage in randomization of locating a bus line. It may be possible to randomize access to bus passes. So there are particular things that you can use RCTs for, but I'm afraid if development economists are going to become wholesale urbanists, if they're going to try and help the policymakers of developing world cities think about many of their larger questions which relate to infrastructure, which relate to land use planning, they're going to need to widen their toolkit. So I think RCTs will always be an important part of that toolkit, but they're unlikely to be the only part as they embrace the future of the developing world, which is overwhelmingly urban.
Ed, the whole paper is a great call to action, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
The paper is called Cities in the Developing World, and the authors are Gerard Bryan, Ed Glaser, and Nick Sivanidis, and it is NBER Working Paper 26390. And I think it's just got another publication as well, hasn't it, Ed?
That's right. It was published online in Volume 12 of the Annual Review of Economics.
Well, congratulations on that. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform. You'll never miss an episode. Or you can find past episodes at voxdev.org.